Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about Iran, about its place on the world stage, and about relations between Iran and the United States. And our guest for the program is Robert Baer. We'll be talking about his recently published book, The Devil We Know. The subtitle is Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Crown is the publisher of the book. Robert Baer is the author of two best-selling books, Sleeping with the Devil, which is about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States, and also See No Evil, which recounts his years as a top CIA operative. That book was the basis for the film Syriana, in which George Clooney played a character based on our guest, Robert Baer. He got an Academy Award for that. Mr. Baer writes regularly for Time.com, has contributed to Vanity Fair, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post. He is considered to be a leading authority on the Middle East and has some very interesting things to say about this book. He says, basically, that many of the things that we perhaps think we know about Iran are incorrect. He says, certainly, Iran is not a country of religious fanatics with terrorist agendas. He says the truth is actually more frightening than that. In the book, he makes the argument that Iran is rapidly modernizing and it's moving into a position of dominance in the Middle East, and that soon we might be left with two choices, or perhaps now we have two choices. One would be conflict with Iran, but the other would be coming to terms with it. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. All we ask is people just are brief so we can keep moving along here. But all questions are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Baer, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks. And yourself?
Good, great.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Just to, I think to begin, maybe the place would be to for me to ask you to talk about the various ways in which we misunderstand Iran, or perhaps that has to do with the way the kind of articles we read about it, or the kinds of things that American elected officials in Congress and in the White House say about it. You seem to be saying is that we have a very fundamental misunderstanding of this country.
Well, primarily, and this has been well established in academic journals and serious press, is that Ahmadinejad, who is such a problem for better relations between us and Iran, isn't the true executive authority. He has a bit of economic power, but he can't take Iran to war. So, in other words, his statements about the Holocaust and destroying Israel or even attacking the United States are irrelevant into real politics. And once we get over that, we have to take a look at Iran's real leadership. And it's not the mullahs that we remember from 1979. Khamenei, the spiritual leader, has the title of Ayatollah, but in fact, he is the military authority in Iran. And in Iran, you could reduce it, and this is an oversimplification, it's a military dictatorship. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and the military and the secret police make all important decisions that affect national security of the country. And it's also a hybrid democracy. Ahmadinejad isn't the preferred president of Iran for the clerics or anybody else in Iran. Really, now he's proven to be a disaster for the Iranians, and he'll probably be gone next year. But we also miss the fact that Iran has traveled this arc from a terrorist state. When we go back to 1979 and the Marine Corps bombing in Beirut, and gradually became more rational and more calculating and less interested in spreading an Islamic revolution. And we're stuck in history. They're not.
Hmm. Well, it seems that, again, sort of the basic one of the basic things you're trying to get across is that what it is that, if you ask this question, well, what it is that's driving Iran that shapes its policy in the region, the bottom line here is is nationalism.
It's purely nationalism. I keep a lot of friends in the Middle East, and many of them are, the Arabs are offended by my book because I basically say that they're politically incompetent, and they haven't been able to do anything ever since they've had their independence from the Ottomans. While, on the other hand, the Iranians have pursued a much more cohesive national interest. Iran is a country that's lived in the same borders for thousands of years. The Arabs live in what I call artificial borders that were created at the end of World War I. So Iran is much more of a threat in terms of an expansionist power, if you accept my premise that it is.
And so your argument is, as far as, if you ask this question, what does the people who are making this policy, the people who are truly running the country, what do they see as Iran's place, or what they would like Iran's place to be, let us just say, in the region, in the Middle East?
I think they want the Persian Gulf. They want the whole thing. They want it back. The Persian Gulf is 90% Shia. Iran is a Shia country. The rim of the Gulf is 90% Shia. The Arab states along the Gulf are weak. Now that Iraq is moving increasingly toward, even with the surge, toward dismemberment, they want a predominant influence in Iraq. They want to keep their influence in Syria and Lebanon, which makes them a Middle East hegemon. But again, I need to define terms. They want an empire through proxy, not an empire through invasion or occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Lebanon. They use Arab proxies. And by the way, the most competent guerrilla force in the world is Hezbollah, and those are Arabs. They're paid for by Iran, directed by Iran, and they have an enormous amount of loyalty to Iran. So we have to look at Lebanon as the model of what Iran would really like to do. It would like to transfer that model to the Palestinians. Now, the question is, what do they ultimately want? Well, you'll have a lot of Iranians talking amongst each other that it's now the Shia millennium. Since 680 AD, the Sunnis have ruled Islam without any exceptions. And they would like to go and change this. I mean, and we're not, the Fatimids in Egypt were Shia, but that's a footnote in history. What they would really like to do is control Mecca and Medina. Now, a lot of Iranians will laugh at that and say that's just impossible. But the point is, the Iranians, by default, are feeling like they are the only serious power in the Middle East.
And just, I have a caller here I want to get to. I'll promise that person I'll not make them wait too much longer. But then now here, the bottom line question is, I'm sure that there would be people in Washington, in the U.S. government, who would say the kind of scenario that you have outlined is a serious threat to the interests and the security of the United States. And they make this argument that the United States should do everything that it could up and to, including waging war against Iran, to prevent them from achieving this goal.
That is an argument, but I don't think, if we look at the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel, it's a war we've missed, pretty much Americans have missed, the Israelis haven't, that this would be such an easy war. Yes, we could march on Tehran in a couple of weeks. Yes, we have air superiority. But it's the consequences that would come of a war like this, and one would be the Iranians would take out oil exports from the Gulf. They could do it very easily within a couple minutes by firing Silkworm missiles. They could also take out Saudi Arabia's main oil facilities. They're not planning on doing this preemptively, but it's a deterrent to our doing anything about Iran. And it's that kind of, that power balance, this, what the military calls asymmetrical power, which would make a war very expensive, and it would look very much like World War III, in a worst-case scenario.
We have, as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Robert Baer. His most recent book is The Devil We Know. The title, subtitle, is Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Crown is the publisher. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in the book. Questions are certainly welcome. We have somebody who will get right to. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, if you'd like to call in. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Baer. I've read your books. I think they're great. I've long been interested in Iran and the United States' relationship to it. I'm kind of curious, and maybe I'm being naive here, but when I look at the relationship between the United States and Iran, it seems to me that there are no, for lack of a better phrase, natural or innate factors that should bring the two countries in opposition to each other. And I know that might sound silly, but I was just trying to kind of back up, see the forest for the trees, and I can't quite see that. And I was wondering if you could shed any insight on that, and to the extent that there's anything to that, is there a way that a more powerful Iran could be, there could be an upside to the United States? And I'll get off and hang up and listen to what you got to say. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let me say, first of all, I don't consider myself, a wide-eyed ideologue in the sense that this isn't, I'm not bashing Washington. What happened with Iran is that it did shed American blood. And for many people inside the government, including this administration and the next, they're going to be looking at these terrorist attacks, the attack on Khobar Barracks in Saudi Arabia. On the other hand, they're not seeing that they've given up terrorism and that Iran could be a natural ally. I mean, I think that Iraq, one of the great success stories that we've all sort of missed, is the Iranians have cooperated in holding that country together when it was on the brink of civil war. They sat down with our ambassador in Baghdad at least twice, and they've told the ambassador, we do not want a civil war. We cannot afford a civil war in Iraq because it will slop over into Iran. We want to help. We want you to leave, yes, but we also want to leave intact a country. And I think the same goes for Afghanistan. The Iranians have been helping us since the early 90s diplomatically against the Taliban. The Taliban is a common enemy. And more than that, if you look at the Middle East negatively, like I do, in the terms of its political cohesion, what better way? I'm talking huge terms here. What better way to hold stability than having Israel on one end on the Mediterranean, Iran on the Persian Gulf, working with the United States? And I think they are a natural ally. We've had a very ugly, nasty history between these two countries. And if we can get over it, like we did with Libya, it would be it would be akin to Nixon flying to Peking in 1974.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the call. Let's go again to another Oswego next. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning. I kind of, we ought to just leave them alone, not even worry about the Middle East. I'm a firm believer that we ought to just pull out of there, let them deal with whatever they need to deal with themselves. Maybe I'm being an isolationist, but we have more problems with the Middle East than anything we could do, and we can't seem to write anything over there, so why do we even care? You know, I kind of firmly believe, too, at the same time, that maybe if we spend less time paying attention to them and dealing with them and more time taking care of our problems here, maybe they'll look at us when they're starting to lose money from us, that maybe they'll look at us in a different light. I'm kind of curious what you think about that. Get off. Thank you very much.
Right.
I have absolutely no argument with that. I mean, I spent 21 years in the Middle East, involved in various covert action, democracy movements and the rest of it. And I can say, speaking personally, it was an utter failure. Everything I ever tried to do, or the CIA or the State Department, failed. Essentially, if those countries are going to become democratic, according to our definition, they're going to do it on their own, and we're not going to force it on them. And we should leave the Middle East because we can't fix it. And what we've put ourselves in, and this was not the intention when we went into Afghanistan or Iraq, is we're becoming a neo-colonial power. This is the way they look at us. When we talk about the war on terrorism, they see colonialism. And the longer we stay, the worse it gets. I mean, there's a report today we spent $6 billion on private security companies in Iraq. The Iraqis cannot look at that other than just an ugly form of colonialism. I mean, these guys are shooting at Iraqi citizens. So we should come home. Here's the thing. In the Middle East, we have two interests. One is Israel. We are emotionally attached to that country. You can argue the national security implications of that all you want. But the other one is oil. We're addicted to cheap oil, and we will be for at least the next 20 years. But Iran has always pumped oil, and has never cut off oil, has never destroyed oil fields. And there's no reason to believe that anybody would stop pumping oil and shipping it to the rest of the world, even if we went away. We should come home. We should take the trillions of dollars we're spending in the Middle East and inject it into the economy, alternative energy, wherever it should go. It's a waste of money. And that's the sum of my experience of 21 years in the Middle East working for the CIA.
Just to underscore something or go back to something that you said, I hear you saying that the reason that our attempts to promote democracy or whatever we were trying to do in the Middle East, it didn't fail because it wasn't just that we didn't find the right strategy. And for people who would say, well, somehow if we just tweaked it a little bit differently or did something different, we'd be successful. It sounds like that you're saying that the whole enterprise right from the get-go was flawed and that it wouldn't have made any difference what strategy we used. We couldn't have achieved the goal.
It was doomed. I mean, you know, we could go on about the neocons all we want and the conservative agenda and, you know, stealing oil and the rest of it. But if you just look on the face of it, Iraq, when we put a constitution in, one man, one vote, it was inevitable the Shia were going to win and that the Shia are beholden to Iran for a long time. I mean, they have no choice. And that certainly wasn't the outcome. But more to the point is that Iraq is an artificial country. It was three Ottoman provinces. And so we're not only trying to implement democracy, we're trying to hold together a nation that really isn't a nation. How do you do that? I mean, is it worth it to us to keep 200,000 troops in that country for 100 years, hoping that it'll become a nation one day? I don't think so. Mm. And that's what nobody looked at is the history, because we have no attention span. And those people do live history. You go to Baghdad now and you go to Tehran and they have these passion plays about the killing of the prophet's grandson. Those people live that. Every year they have these passion plays. And it's much more telling politically this old history than anything in this country can ever be. And this is what we missed. A lot of Americans missed it, not just Washington.
Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Good morning. I'm interested in your reaction to John McCain's little ditty about bombing Iran, and I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think, you know, another war in the Middle East is the last thing we need, and that's to quote Bob Gates, the Secretary of Defense. I think that we've treated Iran as a domestic political issue. It's a way to, you know, it was a political stunt on McCain's part. So I know some of his advisors, and I think they've come to the conclusion that we can't bomb Iran, that there is no such thing as a surgical strike that wouldn't result in enormously damaging consequences all around the Middle East. It'd be fine if we could go in and, you know, take out a nuclear facility and that was the end of the story. We'd you know, kiss and make up, but it wouldn't work that way. I think McCain, in the old days, when he just, you know, was shooting from the hip, I hope if he's elected president he doesn't try, because it would be a catastrophe. The hedge funds tell me, and this was a while ago when oil was higher, that if a war started, they'd immediately start buying gasoline at $10 to $12 a gallon, which obviously we couldn't afford now. And that's not to say we can trust the hedge funds exactly, but we would pay an enormous price for that size war in the Middle East.
What, if, as far as Iran is concerned, is there some sort of immediate practical effect on politics, on its position, that now we have seen a pretty dramatic drop in the price of oil from what it was at its high point last summer?
Well, that's a good question. The question, you know, comes down to, are they going to behave now that they've been pushed, or they will be pushed if oil continues down to the economic edge? My answer to that is that in Lebanon, when oil was going, world marks was $15 a barrel, even $12 a barrel, they continued to pour money into that war in Lebanon. Just like national security is beyond budgets in this country, it's beyond budgets in Iran. They might even become more aggressive, hoping to get out of this. But what we don't know, and we don't know enough about Iran, I certainly don't, about internal politics, to say they're in a pre-revolutionary state. I don't think we can say, all right, if oil stays low, they're going to kneel down and do what we ask. I just don't see that. They never have. They didn't do it during the Iran-Iraq war, which the country was almost destroyed, and I don't think they'll do it now.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is also Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi, I find this conversation very intriguing and a real appreciation for your guests. My question or comment is maybe more a question. How can we trust building partnerships in the Middle East, with the exception of Israel, when, and I ask that question in the background that when the Russians were fighting in Afghanistan, we supported bin Laden. You know, a bad policy. We obviously know that was bad policy back then, and bring it forward, it was certainly bad policy. And then one of the PLO persons that they're trying to pin on Obama right now, Khalidi or whatever that name is.
Khalidi, yeah.
Yes. Here's a guy that when John McCain was chairman of the International Republican Institute, gave $500,000 to do research on the Palestinian issue. To me, we have had flawed indications in the Middle East. But I'm like you, unlike the previous caller, I just don't think we can say, don't talk to Iran. I just think we have to do something about that. Would you just elaborate on that for me, please?
Well, I'd like to start with Waleed Khalidi. I almost ate my newspaper today when I saw that Kalin was attacking him. He's a very moderate, cultured Palestinian who's pressed for dialogue, and he was never a spokesman for the PLO. And if Obama met him at a party, you know, I hope Obama is talking to Arabs and Muslims, you know, I mean, as McCain should be, because we are not in a war of civilization against Islam. Those people don't want to recruit us. They don't want to invade the United States. So we should be talking to all that they can. You know, and the other thing is we have to say that Al-Qaeda is on the ropes. I mean, there hasn't been an attack. You know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed there's not one tomorrow morning. There hasn't been an attack. The Saudis have suppressed this movement internally, which is an enormous achievement. I mean, there's been no attacks there. In Afghanistan, you know, I wonder if bin Laden's still alive. What we don't do in this country is simply discuss the facts. By supporting Israeli settlements in the West Bank, it comes at an enormous cost. Even the Israeli Prime Minister, outgoing Olmert, said this is an enormous cost to peace. We shouldn't be doing this. This is the Israelis. This isn't Americans saying this. Saying they should give up part of East Jerusalem. We have to talk about the real costs and the real facts, because this part of the world, it determines our politics here. It's arguable that we are in this recession now with the price of oil. We just drove the United States over the edge. So we cannot ignore the Middle East. We just have to deal on a more factual basis.
And may I just add, you are exactly right about that. And this is something, now we talk about the Federal Reserve missing the mortgage disaster in this country, but we missed it when it came to inflation. The biggest underlayment for the problems that we have economically is oil prices. And I would just like to finally say, how can we trust Saudi Arabia? Because most of those guys who came over here to do the damage that they did for Arabians.
Yeah, you know, you get me up on my hobby horse now, because it's the Saudis. Look, 15 of the guys, the muscle on those airplanes were Saudis. They were recruited inside Saudi Arabia. in some sort of network that was complicit in this attack that sent them to the United States. Until this day, the Saudis have not identified that network or the cleric that vetted and recruited them to do this operation, which I find very troubling. I find very troubling that we've just ignored this and moved on. We can't trust the Saudis. You know, average Saudis, they're delightful people, but it's an artificial country, and it's driven by fanatics at one end. And still in Iraq, most of the attacks are paid for by Saudis. No, we can't trust them. And it's a bad ally, just like Pakistan is. And you know, I have an adopted Pakistani daughter, so I don't have any prejudice against the country. But our pillars are Pakistan and Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, and they're going to give way, whether oil is high or low. And we have to change the way we look at the world, or we're going to pay an enormous price.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Robert Baer. He's the author of two best-selling books, Sleeping with the Devil, which is about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States, and also the book See No Evil, which is an account of his years as a CIA operative and was the basis for the film Syriana. He has written for Time.com, contributed to Vanity Fair, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and does a lot of speaking and talking and writing about the Middle East. And his newest book is about Iran. The title is The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. It's published by the Crown Press. It's out now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi, I have two questions from Mr. Baer. So the first one is that you show a very interesting picture for the relationship between Iran and Arabs in the Middle East. My question is, how does the relationship between Iran and Israel work, and how does it relate with the relationship between Iran and Arabs? And the second question is that, you know, coming from Iran, I know that the Iranian society is a very divided society. So you are right at showing what the intentions of the first half of, you know, the Iranian society, you know, how they work and how they think. And well, they are the maybe a slight majority, and that's why they are still in power. But there is this other half of Iranian society which, you know, are pro-real democracy. And so I was wondering, like, how would that factor play in the game? Thank you very much.
I think that's an important question. I mean, you go to Iran, and I haven't spent it, you know, my entire career there. I've been there a couple times, and what strikes you is the modernization and sophistication of the country. And, you know, more than half of Iran does not look at the clerics in a particularly favorable light. But the Iranians have a very deep sense of justice and injustice. So if we put them in the terms of Axis and Evil, or call them a totalitarian state, or, you know, the Iranians, here's one argument, they say, look, you guys invaded the wrong country when you went into Iraq. It wasn't us. So who's at fault here? And I think that even if you had a complete democracy from top to bottom in Iran, you would still have Iran that would look at its national interests in the Middle East. And two of them would be, again, stability in Iraq and stability in Afghanistan. That would even be a liberal democracy. And you would always have, there'd be an attachment from every Iranian to the welfare of the Palestinians as fellow Muslims. The Iranians at every level would like to see a fair settlement. I mean, it'd be essentially the same settlement as Olmert proposed 2 weeks ago. Give up the West Bank, give up Gaza, and part of East Jerusalem. This is a conservative Israeli, by the way. So I see what this, my book is pretty much a good news story, is because when you have conservative Israelis talking in the same way the Iranians do, you know, go to Resolution 242, which passed in 1967, and there has been a connection between Iran and Tel Aviv, which has been very strong, and it continues to this day. And what I'm hoping is that the Israelis start a back channel with Tehran and come to a solution, a peaceful solution, which would involve disarming Hezbollah and so forth, and then simply come to Washington, sort of like the Oslo Agreement, present it to the next president. The next president says, fine, and we support it. Now, you know, solutions like that in the Middle East are often dreams, but there's always a possibility.
Well, so you do you think here that, though, that the kinds of things that we have heard coming out of Iran, and I suppose recently they've been coming out of the mouth of one person, and that's the president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, about wiping Israel off the map. Is that just talk?
That's just talk. I mean, the best protected Jewish community in the Middle East is outside of Israel. I mean, actually, the world is in Tehran. I mean, the Iranian regime goes out of its way to protect that community, and it's a vibrant community. I mean, the immigration is still going on to Israel, but this we're not talking, or even Christianity in Iran. They don't bother them. This isn't Saudi Arabia, where you can't even put a Christmas wreath on your door. The regime leaves them alone. They don't try to convert them. They don't oppress them. They've done this very intentionally. So when Ahmadinejad talks, it's rhetoric when he talks about wiping Israel off the map. I think deep down, the Iranians say, and I believe them, the regime, that they would accept any agreement that the Palestinians can live with, which should probably, I would hope, would be Resolution 242.
All right, let's talk with some others. In Champaign County next, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to raise the issue that Cy Hirsch has brought up, and Andrew Coburn actually was leaked a secret finding that shows that there was a bipartisan assent to escalating another $300 million and opening assassinations as a possibility in the covert war against Iran. It's not talked about. Pakistan, we have a overt covert operation there, and we're not supposed to talk about that, but it seems that neither side will own up to the fact that there is this proxy war with the Balukis and the MEK and all these other sorts, and some internal dissenters, and Arabs in the south, and that there's documentary evidence that we're doing this. We're already at war with Iran, and it's just not brought up. So what do you think about it? I'm curious to see how you'll respond.
Well, you know, the worst piece of news was this attack on Syria a couple days ago. And when they crossed at Abu Kamal, which is a little border town in the desert, and attacked a house. Now, I don't know who was killed. The Bush administration said it was terrorist, or whatever you want to call them. This is the expanded Bush doctrine, which says you can cross borders and assassinate people. This man, if indeed they got the right guy, he was assassinated. Now, the military, when I used to deal with them, is legally permitted under U.S. law to destroy, you're going to laugh at the words, but it's true, destroy command nodes. So if using that law, the Bush administration has and continues to send people across the Iranian border to kill people. And it's been very limited until this point. Now, ironically, the most dangerous group to the Iranians is a Qaeda-affiliated group, and that's in Balochistan. It's called Jundallah. And there's been contacts with Jundallah, and Hirsch is a friend of mine. I mean, I think he quotes me in that article. And now these guys have been going into Iran and cutting off the heads of Iranian soldiers. And they've been photographing this, and they went on the news and the rest of it. All we're doing in this case is stirring up Shia-Sunni divisions, Qaeda versus Iran, which, you know, if we keep doing this, or crossing borders, we will get into a hot war with Iran, or we will cause what I call the Mad Max approach to the Middle East, is just get everybody killing each other. You know, and you know, once that happens, you know, a large war, you just don't know where it's going to go.
Right. Vis-a-vis you raising the Syrian attack, an Iraqi friend of mine last night told me that he thought that attack was actually a warning to anybody that wants to develop the major gas field that's right there on the border, and that Syria has been talking to Sarkozy, amongst other people, about developing. I don't know what to make of that. He said that the site that was actually attacked was a work site that was actually developing the sort of the pipeline.
Look,
I don't know what to make of it, but he has better contacts in the area than I do. Thanks a lot.
All right. I don't know. You want to, Mr. Baer, you want to comment on that at all?
Well, let me just say something about Iran. It's one of the great fears of the anti-Iranian lobby is that Iran is going to set up a deal with Qatar, which has enormous gas reserves, Russia and Iran. You basically control Europe's energy for the next 50 years, which would be what the neocons would really call an axis of evil, Russia and Iran and that sort of thing. I mean, we're all looking at energy corridors in the Middle East, and we don't want Syria to become one because it's too independent for our liking. And it's about our addiction to oil. We are addicted, and we have enormous influence over the world if we can control the Middle East.
All right, let's continue. We have another caller, and the next is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I find myself agreeing with you more than I expected from the introduction given. I do have one quibble, I guess. The possibility of Iranian hegemony in the Middle East. It seems to me that there's a very great barrier to this. The relationship of the Arabian peoples and the Iranians is very complicated. And while there's great respect for the Iranians, there's also some deep-seated antagonisms. Iran and Iran-Persia, and the Byzantine and later the various Turkish dynasties in modern Turkey fought over the Middle East for a couple of thousand years. And that's remembered much better than we Americans might think. And while there's this great respect for the Persians, because they were, of course, the establishers of the Middle Eastern civilization to a great extent. In some respects, they were even the teachers of the Greeks, their civilization being older than that of the Greek. But at the same time, there's this antagonism which I think would limit their influence over the Arab peoples. Would you speak to this? And I might have some follow-ups.
That is when we went into Iraq, that was one of the largest arguments was that the Iranians would never get a foothold there because they were Persians. The Persians are Indo-European people. The same group we're from. But what I noticed, I worked a lot in Lebanon. I was there during the Civil War, is Iran's ability to create Hezbollah and turn it into a guerrilla force. And not only that, but impose discipline on Arabs. And it was a voluntary association, which has continued since 1982. And that is the template the Iranians hope to reproduce across the Middle East. And Iran is extremely popular. And the Palestinians look at them as the one country that's willing to help them. And this is what the Iranians are counting on. Now, ultimately, history will tell. But Lebanon, I use as the example where the Iranians have overcome this ethnic difference to carry on.
Well, they've managed to do this in the past. And I don't mean to say that I don't think they would have influence. I think they would have great influence. But I don't think it would be overwhelming influence. There was a confluence of interests with Hezbollah and, for that matter, Hamas. They were working for a common end, but it seems to be that when there isn't this confluence of interest, the Arab peoples are perfectly capable of going their own way.
I think absolutely in Iraq, that given stability in Iraq, the Arab Shia would going back to being independent, simply because in many ways, the Iraqi Shia, especially the clerics, don't look at the Iranians as completely Islamicized. I mean, there's, you've got the Zoroastrian underlying of, you know, pre-Islamic culture in Iran. And Iran is an enormously complicated country, and they are really, people look different, they talk different. Even the Iranians that speak fluent Arabic just don't sound like Arabs. I think that if we got into a position where we settled all sorts of issues like Lebanon and the Palestinian issue, that this wind would be taken out of the Iranian sail. But as long as we remain in this confrontation across the Middle East, they will have a hearing. You know, if we could move on Resolution 242 with the Palestinians, as well as integrate Hezbollah into the military, which is possible, the Iranians would quickly lose what I call an empire. But more than, I use the word empire not as in terms of occupation, Persian occupation, but again, it goes back to the oil, so it's two-pronged. It's both ideological and economic that they have such enormous power, and of course, the fact that we destroyed their two enemies in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's a great confluence for Iran at this point. And the question is whether they're going to be able to carry it on into some new kind of empire. It's going to depend how we react.
We just have about 10 minutes left, and we have two other callers. I'd like to try to get them in here, and also to introduce a guest for this hour, Robert Baer. He's the author of the book Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the U.S. See No Evil, it's about his years as a CIA operative, was the basis for the film Syriana. His most recent book is The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, and it is published by Crown. We have some other callers here, and we'll go next to someone on a cell phone on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Yes, I would just like to ask your guest if he could weigh in or knows anything about I recalled seeing a little reported story that Halliburton several years back had offices in Tehran and was doing some kind of business with nuclear technology, and that somebody within the Iranian government who handled, you know, nuclear affairs was, like, detained or was taken out of his position because he was, like, the point person dealing with Halliburton, and there might have been an exchange of secrets or something to that effect. And I was just wondering if the guest could weigh in on that.
Halliburton was working in Iran through a Dublin office, as I recall, and it was mainly positioning itself to sell oil equipment. The problem, any time there's a commercialization, a trade like this, where there's no accounting for it, all sorts of equipment that shouldn't go end up in these countries. And I think the real point is that sanctions don't work. It hurts the average Iranian, his unemployment and the rest of it. But when it comes to the government can get almost any technology it wants, whether it's through Halliburton or the rest of it. I mean, just the way commerce works, these things don't work. So, I mean, to underline the point, is sanctions aren't going to change Iran's behavior, at least in the short term.
Do you just, on the question of developing nuclear weapons, has been one of the huge bones of contention between the U.S. And the government of Iran. What do you feel you have some insight into what is exactly the Iranian intention when it comes to developing nuclear? Obviously, they say they're just interested in developing nuclear power to generate energy, and the United States says no. What they're interested in is developing a nuclear weapons program so they can build weapons.
Well, they have two goals here. One is they would like nuclear energy because they'd like to export their oil. It's a country of 70 million plus people. They have the most inefficient oil fields in the Middle East, some of the oldest oil fields. If they don't find new oil fields, they're going to run out. But the remaining oil they would like to use to export and, you know, build other industries there with those profits. But at the same time, the Iranians look at Iraq. It's a country that we can't I'm sorry. They look at Iraq and they say, look, we invaded Iraq. What did Saddam miss? Mm-hmm. What he didn't have was nuclear weapons.
So that they're, so yeah. your argument is that they're looking at this fundamentally as a defensive posture, as a deterrent,
not an offensive.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk with someone in Belgium. That is the community that's not all that far from here. Line number two. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Earlier in your discussion, I got the impression from you that you alluded to, or something like that, I could say, that truly the basis of this Middle Eastern problem might very well lie at the feet of the Saudi Arabians, or at least the regime that's in control of Saudi Arabia right now, anyway. Well, my question to you is, from what I've heard all this, who are their friends? Who are their allies? They seem to fight with just about everybody.
The Saudis?
Yes, sir.
They do. Well, I mean, they're extremists. I mean, they are, there's no question about it. I mean, they are, have a form of Islam, and they oppress the Shia. So that's another thing that's given Iran power or influence over the rest of the Middle East, is they're just so oppressive to the Saudi Shia. And the Iranians are saying, this is just patently unfair, and we have to do something about it. And this kind of message is helping them recruit Iraqis.
No, sir. No, you're missing the point I'm saying. I'm asking about the Saudi regime that's in Saudi Arabia right now. They seem to be only so self-interested that they don't really have any natural allies, even in the Arabian world or any place else in the world. It's strictly business to them.
You're absolutely right. I mean, they don't have any. I mean, the Saudis are detested across the Middle East. You take even Syrian Sunnis despise them simply because they are arrogant, they're rich, and they're trying to pawn off this extreme form of Islam. And they are one of the major supporters of, for instance, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Osama bin Laden. I mean, even though they had, I don't think the government had anything to do with 9/11, but they still, a lot of this money found its way into bin Laden's coffers. And the only thing that really props the Saudi regime up is wealth, money. They can buy off tribes. They can buy off countries like Yemen, Oman, and the rest of it. And in that sense, I think the regime is very fragile.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're down to the point where we have about 2 minutes. And I, as a way of finishing up, you have suggested that in the book that essentially we have three options. We could do pretty much what we're doing now in the effort to try to contain Iran, which would mean the continuation of a significant military strength in the region. There's the possibility of provoking a war between Sunni and Shia. That's the thing you referred earlier to as the Mad Max option. Let's go to the third option, which is the one I'm sure that you would advocate, and that is to settle with Iran. What would we have to do, do you think, on our side, to try to work out a working relationship with Iran?
I think what we need to do right today is hammer out an agreement, a basic agreement. The Iranians aren't insisting that we remove our bases from Iraq. But what they are insisting to the local government, to Maliki, the prime minister, is that those bases not become launching pads for an attack on Iraq, which makes complete sense. I mean, from an Iranian standpoint, you come to an accommodation with the Iranians in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you start this dialogue where you can actually produce concrete results and get over the rhetoric, and then I think we should start thinking about lifting sanctions piecemeal. I mean, the Iranians, there's no reason why we shouldn't let them buy advanced oil equipment, and they're not going to turn this equipment and use it as weapons. Lift sanctions, and then immediately move to the question of Palestine and Lebanon. The Israelis cannot have a hostile force that can rocket them from Lebanon. Hezbollah needs to be integrated into the Lebanese army. And then you take those two issues, and the Iranian problem pretty much goes away. I mean, and the point is now they're not supporting terrorism, so we're not really having to ask them to do anything on that level. We want them to continue. And I think that once we have fewer troops, in Afghanistan and the Middle East, they're going to get to the point where they're going to postpone indefinitely a nuclear weapon. The Iranians know that if they set off a test weapon in one of their deserts, the whole international community will come down on them. They simply can't do it. And so it's not, they won't have that hard of a time giving up a nuclear weapon. And I think they will throw open their sites for inspection. And, you know, it's, we've got four simple steps there, and they're all doable.
And if
I'm not asking for world peace. I'm just, go ahead.
And if we, I was just going to say, and if we do, if we withdraw our troops to that extent, can we expect Iran to help us with our al-Qaeda problem?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, al-Qaeda, those people are beyond negotiating with. Yes, we can. What we want to do is work with the Iranians to keep the Taliban from returning to Kabul. The Iranians were appalled when Bob Gates said maybe we could accommodate ourselves to the Taliban. They might come back in the government if they promise to be good. The Iranians know better than we do that these people are they're irredeemable. And I think, you know, with all these common interests, but a smart administration, whether it's McCain or Obama, can work this out. And I think we can bring the Israelis along. But the Israelis they're saying you've got to do something about these rockets in Lebanon and rockets that can hit Israel. All negotiable. If Iran is indeed a country that follows its national interests and you have a rational leadership.
We will have to stop there. We're at the end of our time. You want to read more of our guests' thinking on the subject, you look for the book The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, published by Crown, by our guest Robert Baer. He is a contributor to Vanity Fair, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and is also authors of the book Sleeping with the Devil, which is about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the U.S., and also See No Evil. It's about his experiences as a CIA operative, was the basis for the film Syriana. Mr. Baer, thank you very much.
By the way, it's all great questions. Smart listeners you got there.
Well, we think so, too.